Okay. It's a pleasure to welcome everyone to the Ontolog Forum session on OWL tools and applications. It's Thursday, the 5th of August 2010, in case anyone's listening to this after the event. It's a very interesting lineup today of five panelists who are going to tell us about various different OWL tool applications, after which I hope we'll be able to have a very interesting discussion. So just briefly, introduce all of the speakers and several short prior to the meeting. So first we have Matthew Smith from University of Manchester, who's going to tell us about the OWL API, which I'm sure many people will already be familiar with. It's one of the most widely used, probably the most widely used API for OWL applications. Then I think I'm right in saying it's actually Timothy Redmond that we have from Stanford, who's going to tell us about the Protégé tool suite, which again I'm sure many of us are familiar with. It's probably the most widely used OWL editing tool. Then Andreas Haar is going to tell us about the NEON project, and in particular the NEON toolkit. He's from AIFB, Institute of Technology at Aalborg University, I should say, by the way. NEON is what you might call the new kid on the ontology engineering block, and it provides also a whole range of ontology development functions. Next is going to be Evren Tyrin from Spartan Parsia, and Evren's going to tell us about Pellet. Again, Pellet probably doesn't need much introduction. It's one of the most widely used OWL 2 reasoners. And finally, I believe we have Zewu from Oracle, and he's going to tell us about an application of OWL in using the Oracle database to support integrated collaboration object modeling. I'm afraid I don't know too much about that, so we'll have to find out about that when he gives us his presentation. Okay, so first up is Matthew. Matt, are you ready to go?
Thanks, Ian. Okay, so I'm Matthew Horridge from the University of Manchester, and I'm going to talk about the OWL API, which is a Java API for working with OWL 2 ontology. Next slide, please. Slide 2. So the OWL API is an API for creating, loading, and manipulating OWL 2 ontologies. It offers a common reasoner interface with various reasoners, and that provides OWL reasoning. It's open source and it's licensed under the LGPL license. The latest version of the API is version 3, and this is the website targeted to OWL 3. And in this talk today, I'm going to give a bit of a flavour of the design philosophy, give an overview there. I'm going to talk through some of the main components of the API, and just present you with some ideas for applications and what you can do with the API. So next slide, please. So although the latest version of the OWL API is rather new, the API itself has been around for quite a while. So the first version was released in 2003, and this was just before OWL 1 became a recommendation. And it was characterized by the fact that it was a high-level API, syntax neutral. It was based on what was underneath OWL abstract syntax. At the time, other APIs were RDS-based and direct exposed clients to the serialization of OWL ontologies that are used for different ontologies. But the OWL API took a rather different approach here. And major features of the API included the ability to work cleanly with multiple ontologies. It included nice change support, amongst other things. And then in 2005, there was an OWL meeting, I think it was the first one, and there was a discussion there about moving to the next version of OWL and what was needed. And after this, in between OWL 1 and OWL 2 came an interim version of OWL. And in 2007, a version of the API was released to deal with this interim version. And in this API, OWL API version 2, there was a shift from the frame-like syntax of frame-like closing that was used in the OWL object syntax now 1, and this shifted towards an action-oriented view. And in fact, the OWL API version 2 was really the precursor to what you see today, so they're actually quite similar. So this leads me to the final version of the OWL 2 spec in 2009, when it became a recommendation. And shortly after, we released the OWL API version 2.5 at the beginning of this year. Okay, next slide. Slide 4. So, with version 3 of the API and OWL 2 being a recommendation, we closely aligned the OWL API with the spec. And basically, what we did was take the OWL 2 specification and we directly translated it. Or more or less directly translated this into Java interfaces rather than ontology. Of course, we need some other bits and pieces, and I'll explain later. But basically, if you read through the OWL 2 documents and specifications, it's not too much of a leap towards how the OWL API version 3 works. Next slide, slide 5. So, what we actually did was basically for every class in the structural specification, the OWL 2 structural specification, you can find a corresponding interface in the OWL API. So it's almost a straightforward translation from the UML diagrams in the OWL specification, these really clean, nice diagrams, into OWL API interfaces. And we did have some intermediate interfaces to help us organize things and for housekeeping. And these just slot in. So, for example, on this slide, you see the interfaces in the structural specification that were derived from that in blue. That's OWL subclass of axioms, for example. And then OWL API-specific interfaces that augment these in orange. So, for example, we spotted in this interface OWL logical axiom to differentiate between logical axioms and annotation axioms. But basically, if you look at the structural specification, and then you start to use the OWL API, you can see the alignment between the two immediately. Okay, this is a great advantage. Next slide, please. Slide 6. Of course, in addition to the basic structures for representing ontologies, we need some other machinery, and basically this includes the following. So we've got the management of ontologies themselves, so their creation, loading them from systems, saving ontologies, managing imports between ontologies. All this comes in the umbrella of ontology management. In keeping with all of the previous versions of the OWL API, we have change objects for applying changes to ontologies. We've got clean change support that provides a whole host of benefits. And with that, we've got listener support as well for listening to changes. There's various sub-APIs to the API itself that support common tasks. For example, syntactic validation of ontologies, looking at metrics from ontologies, various normalization of axioms and class expressions, which are useful for various things. And the big one is, as well, we've got reasoning, well-defined reasoning interfaces, that various OWL reasoners provided implementations for. And so it all packages together that you can use to write OWL to base applications. Next slide, please. So I mentioned that the OWL API is a high-level API. In fact, there is no commitment to a particular concrete syntax. And in the high-level API interfaces themselves, you don't see any details of any kind, any specific concrete like RDF, for example. And what you see here on this slide, though, is a diagram that's taken from the OWL 2 specification document. and this shows really that the whole ontology structure itself is independent of any concrete serialization syntax. But as can be seen if you look at the orange box in the middle, any OWL2 implementation must support parsing and serializing of ontologies in RDFXML, and seems like a compliant OWL2 implementation, we do it. But the OWL API supports all these other syntaxes as well, loading ontologies from these syntaxes and saving ontologies out of these syntaxes. All of these optional syntaxes here, so for example, we support the Manchester syntax, that's a human readable media-to-read syntax. The functional syntax, which is high-level syntax, is to describe various structures. OWL XML, this is part XML syntax for OWL, and Turtle, for the specified depth syntax. We actually support some other syntaxes that aren't on the slide out of the box, and these are KRSF2, which is used to communicate with race reasoner. And also, we can, to some extent, load ontologies in the OWL flat file format, so OWL ontologies we can pass and serialize those to. And basically, we think it's easy to add support for other syntaxes. So in the reference implementation of the API, there's a registry of parsers, and on a load request, the appropriate path is automatically selected. Clients don't have to bother with the details of what the syntax or ontologies are serialized in. So you could have multiple ontologies in different syntaxes, and the API will take care of that. Of course, all of this can be changed. It's just what the reference implementation of the API does. So all of these parsers load ontologies into main memory, and by and large, this is efficient. So next slide, please. So the reference implementation provides fairly efficient in-memory storage model, which is quick for loading and accessing ontologies. And actually, with modern computers, laptops, which have plentiful supplies of memory, loading huge ontologies is giving a problem that it wants for. So we can comfortably load ontologies like SNOMED, really large ontology, or the National Cancer Institute ontology, fairly fast and efficiently. The API includes interfaces though, so that you can provide different implementations for storage. So, for example, if you wanted to store an ontology in a database, some people like to do this. In fact, I think it's going to be mentioned in one of the talks later. The API implementation allows you to specify types of ontologies and storers so that you could, for example, store ontology in a database, in a triple store, and what have you. And the reference implementation makes it possible to do this. And there's just one of the third-party implementation of OWLDB, which is an open-source database back-end to the OWL API. Far others, and you'll hear about one later. Next slide, please.
That's slide 9 now, in case anyone's losing track.
Yeah, slide 9. one of the main parts of working with OWL is reasoning. This is that reasoning is part of working with OWL. And in fact, I would go as far as for client applications that aren't editors, trying to figure out what an ontology says by inspecting the syntax of the ontology using an API, not using a reasoner. But like trying to determine the behavior as a result of a complex computer program by inspecting the source code rather than compiling and running the program. So with this in mind, the OWL API provides a reasoner phase, common reasoner interface for OWL reasoners, that different reasoner implementation is provide implementations for. And there's various reasoner implementers that have done this. And this is beneficial for client expectations because it's easy for them to swap in and swap out different reasoners, try different reasoners in the same ontologies, without too much effort, without any change to the without much change to the client code. And it's also beneficial for reasoning developers because it provides the reasoner to a lot of applications that it might not otherwise be using, and with the advantage to suppose is that there's lots of users providing interesting test cases for them. In the latest version of the API, so the version the reasoner interfaces were overhauled quite a lot, and there's plenty of documentation now, and we need that it's particularly well documented, and this to ensure consistency across the system. next slide, please. Another significant part of the ALF specification is the profile specification, and I understand that Ian presented the profile this week. And the API, the ALF API, contains various mechanisms for detecting what profile an ontology is in, and provides reports of the features that take an ontology out of the profile. For the correspondence with the specification that the API is based on, made the implementation of the profile checker fairly straightforward and easy. And so after passing an ontology in any of the concrete syntaxes, we can just check against the resulting structures that the ontology get passed into and see which profile the ontology falls in. So the API ships with implementation checks whether an ontology is in one of the R profiles, L2EL, L2QL, 2RL. But the notion of profiles in the API is a little bit more general, so we also tend to talk about profile validation, see whether an ontology actually falls into what we call an NPL profile or an L2 profile. And it's quite easy actually to customize this, and you can, if you're doing the research, provide some other profile checker for the ontology of choice. Profile information can be accessed programmatically, so if we've got a profile violation, fairly straightforward to find out what the cause of the problem is, which axioms, which parts of axioms are causing the problem. And this is rather useful, so for example, if you want to integrate profiling information into applications, editors, or checkers. So for example, in the next slide, slide 11, this is a screenshot of a profile validator that's available over the web, hosted at Manchester on the L.ps at Manchester, the AP.uk website. And this just uses the L API with a thin layer over the top of it to the profile report into HTML and highlight the parts of actions that cause the ontology to fall outside of the profile. And so I've now covered what I think are the main design points and functionality of the API. And this mention of profile validator leads me on to some of the kind of functionality that can actually be incorporated into applications that use the API. So slide 12. So the API is well suited to a variety of applications. It, for example, is widely used in some ontology editors, two of which you're going to hear about later, so Protégé 4, the Neon Toolkit. There's other ones that sweep that use the early versions of the API, there's the web browser, our site that uses the API as well, and others. And just to illustrate some of the applications and things to do with the API, I'm just going to use some of the features of Protégé 4 to illustrate them. Next. The API ships with various sub-APIs, and one of these is the Metrics API. It's pretty easy actually to insert metrics in an ontology, such as the different types of axioms in an ontology, the expressivity, and so on. And that ships with default implementations of various metrics, various kinds of metrics, but all things extensible and portable, so people can plug in their own kinds of metrics. Yes. Next slide. The benefit of working with axioms actually can't be overstated. So working with axioms in the way that the API is consumer-centric rather than being string-centric, like the old API dealing with L1, means that it's very easy to retrieve the definitions and all references for it to keep. So for example, it's very easy to get all of the signature, and that is all the actions that reference the class, and it's very easy to obtain different parts of the ontology that contain signatures like this. And this is in contrast to getting this usage information with the frame-based API, which is rather difficult, basically the API 1. And doing this with even more low-level APIs, such as RDS APIs, is quite painful, whereas complicated high-level approach with axioms is rather easy. Next slide. So the OWL APIs always make it easy to work with multiple ontologies, and the latest version makes things even easier, I think. So, for example, it's very easy to track where statements, actions come from. It's easy to find out which ontologies they belong into. It's clear cut. This is easier to work with the import closure ontologies, and for example, this is quite beneficial for tools like editors, where you might need to know all of the two classes that cross with respect to the import closure, which is a particular ontology, and find out where these statements are being made. It's pretty easy to do this. Next slide. I mentioned the change objects before, clean change support. These were present in the very first version of the OWL API, and they've been there right through to the latest version. And large changes can be composed of smaller changes, and the benefits of this are quite widespread. So, for example, it's particularly useful for things like undo and redo operations in editors, or for reasoners to process what changes have been made to an ontology so they can figure out how to update their structures. And things like push straightforward, which don't have the OWL API, can get all this functionality for almost free. So all of the undo redo functionality and tools is quite easy to implement. It's also the basis of the change broadcast strategy that the API can use for managing things like change broadcast. Okay, next slide, slide 17. The common redo interface is particularly nice. As I mentioned before, we think redoing is very important and is an intrinsic part of working with OWL. And the API provides a common redo interface, and very well-known redoer implementers have implemented this for their redoers. So, for example, got Quack++, Hermit, JSTEL, Pellet, RaceFlow, SnowRocket, to name a few. And this is a huge bonus to applications that can just deal with one redo interface at a very high level, rather than having to delve into each API for each redo. Next slide. Mentioned serialization here, but applications like Protege can support several syntaxes out of the box with pretty much zero effort on the part of the application developer. So as I say, you just load, point the OWL API at the URL, load the file and ontology, and it figures out what to do, basically, providing its role form. Next slide, related to syntax, we have the various components and parsers that can be used directly. So here you see the editing of an ontology and cross expressions. And we've got the components of the parser used to provide some auto completion and suggestions here. And this infrastructure is used all provided by the OWL API. Slide 20. Finally, then, well, what you see here is an explanation workbench where we're showing justifications for entailment, so why is this entailment causing the ontology, and this really, again, just emphasizes the benefit of working with axioms and the axiom-oriented approach that the API takes. It makes it really easy to deal with certain tasks where the low-level approaches that are specific to certain syntaxes just don't make any sense. Okay, next slide. So we're just running off now, and the OWL API is fairly widely used, and the state underpins some of the tools that you'll hear about in the next talk. We've had over 17,000 downloads of version 2 and version 3, version 2 and 3 series of the API, and actually this doesn't take into consideration the number of people who download it and use it via tools like Protege4 or the Neon Toolkit, or indeed any of the reasons like Pellet and Hermit, which also ship the OWL API. So, just to wrap up then, next slide, I'm just going to finish off with some acknowledgements. So, the first person I should acknowledge is Sean Beckhoffer, here at Manchester. Sean started the whole process in the first place, back in 2003, with the first versions of the API, and he's been pretty much here ever since, offering advice and way forward. Next slide. I'd like to thank these people, Beard Diggle and Boris Moffat and Tim Redmond. They've offered a lot of input into the design of the version 3 of the API when we were discussing it in the early days. In particular, Beard Diggle and Boris gave a lot of feedback with regards to the user interfaces and ironing out problems there. There's also Ignacio Pontano, who's been started at Manchester recently. He's looking at some of making the API thread safe. Providing thread safe implementation, concurrent implementation, They're doing a lot of work in that area. Next slide. And I'm here as people who've contributed to the coal base in one way or another. There's Ron Alford from Maryland, Nick Drummond from Manchester, Olaf Nappen from Ulm University, Thomas Schneider from Manchester, Evelyn Schrin from Clark and Parthia, and Mike Smith, who was also at Clark and Parthia. All of these people have contributed with the coal base, so thanks to them too. And that just about wraps it up. So,
okay.
I think we'll keep questions to the end if that's okay, Mark. I think it's worked better. So thanks a lot for that. That was really interesting. We'll move on now then to Tim's presentation. Can I just mention to all the presenters that we were hoping that the talks wouldn't run over more than about 20 minutes. I think that that Matt's talk was just about on the limit there, and if everybody can try to make sure that their talks are in the range 15 to 20, otherwise we'll run out of time for discussion at the end. So I won't waste any more time. Tim, if you're ready.
So this talk is actually going to be done by both me and Tanya Chidorati, and I'm going to talk about Protégé 401 and Web Protégé. So next slide, number two. So Protégé 401 is a comprehensive ontology development plugin platform. It's based on Java, so it can be run on several platforms. It uses the Eclipse plugin registry mechanism to use plugins, and the plugin platform is a very key part of what Protégé 401 is about. And it's at the inside core level, it gets its L2 compatibility by more than compatibility compliance through the use of the L API. And it also has a very complete implementation of the L2 feature set. So okay, next slide, number three. Okay, and so in addition, some recent developments, often collaborative ontology development is often very important. There's a client-server code that's in progress. We have a working version, although it's not really ready for people to use yet, and we're planning to do collaborative extensions. And there's also a database backend. Next slide, number four. So this is a picture of what the user interface looks like. Many people may be familiar with it. What this display shows here is the classes tab, and the tab is made up of multiple views. The views that you actually see on the screen are three of them. On the left-hand side, there's a class hierarchy view, which shows the class hierarchy. And it also shows that a certain class is selected, the adding substance to cell culture class is selected. And then on the right-hand side, there are two views. At the top, there's the annotations view, and the bottom, there is a description view. And these views, this can be rearranged. The user can decide that he wants to have other views in this tab, or he can say certain views are relevant to what he does. And so this can be customized by a user to what the user wants. This thing is also, it's driven by selection, so that when the user selects an entity, so he selects the adding substance to cell culture, the views respond to the fact that that class is selected. So the annotations view in the top right is showing annotations such as the person who edited his definition, the source. The description view shows some of the axioms that are associated with this. The other thing I wanted to say about this this user interface is it's very principled based on OWL API, OWL2 specifications, so that if you look at the description view, which is the bottom right-hand side, the equivalent classes that corresponds to an axiom, the superclasses, each of those are axioms saying that the adding substance to cell culture is a subclass of defined processes. This makes it very easy for us to verify, you know, that the Protégé 4.1 is really compliant with the L2 specifications and that we have implemented things correctly. And then the final thing that I would indicate here is that inference is built in to the Protégé 4.1 implementation at every level. So in the description view, the highlighted at the bottom, there's a highlighted in on colorblind, but I would say it's yellow. Adding material entity to a target. That class is an inferred superclass, and so it's so the inference is built in there. And there are also some views. It's not actually showing on the screen, but if you look on the left, there's class hierarchy inferred that could be selected, which shows the inferred class hierarchy. And okay, so I'm ready for the next slide, number 5. These are basically the points that I was bringing up in the last slide. This slide really is sort of a companion to the last one. So I'm ready for number 6. The next slide. Sorry. Protégé 4 also has some advanced visualization capabilities. The thing that we're kind of favoring these days is Ontograph because it's very flexible. It doesn't depend on an external program like ALViz. You have to make sure that DOT is installed, and that's always a hassle. But this is a very nice visualization tool and has many different modes. I'll show you another one on the next slide, number 7. Oh, sorry. Next slide, number 7, shows ALViz. So this is another visualization thing, and this is actually kind of useful for certain ontologies. It allows you to see the import tree in ALViz, which oftentimes the import tree is actually, well, not tree, graph, is very simple for most ontologies, but for the OB ontology in particular, it's sufficiently complicated that you probably could not figure out what it's about unless you use this kind of visualization tool. Next slide, number 8. I mentioned before that Protégé 4.1 was a pluggable system. So my first item here is the 140 plugins. This is not to say, you know, Protégé 4.1 has an incredible amount of functionality. What this tells you is that we use the plugin architecture in a very real way. I mean, if you take out the plugins, you basically don't see much of anything. Everything is a plugin in Protégé, and the core system, I did a count just by looking at the source files, and I got 138 just for the core ontology, the core editor support, and the OWL editor by itself. And then there's a handful more in the other plugins, the visualization plugins, the LQuery plugins that come with the core distribution. Protégé 4 has some visualization plugins, has many inference plugins. And there really should be another bullet here because there are many, many plugins that have been written for Protégé 4.1. In fact, if you go to the Protégé Wiki, protégéwiki.stanford.edu, you can see a bunch of plugins. In addition, plugins can be automatically loaded if you need them. There's an interface by which you can go searching for plugins and see if there's one that you can use. Okay. Next slide. Thank you. A very popular feature with Protégé 3 and a very important part of why Web Protégé is useful is the ability to do collaborative editing. And in Protégé 4.1, we developed a client server. We basically are going to take advantage of lessons learned from Protégé 3. I mean, a lot of work happened in a Protégé 3 client server, and it's been very successful, but it also has been the source of many headaches. In Protégé 4.1, we decided to do better. We've changed the paradigm. In some ways, the paradigm is more like a checkout and a commit paradigm. Although you can see your you can see changes occur in real time if you want. So the server responsibilities are essentially can be summarized as the ability to check out ontologies, to update ontologies to get the latest, and to commit changes. The server is designed in a pluggable way also. The conflict management is pluggable. The RPC is manageable and is pluggable in the server backend. So up east, probably the most important part to be pluggable is the conflict management, because different groups will want different kinds of conflict management. For instance, the kind of thing that Protégé 3 implements is basically essentially sort of a null conflict management, the last guy wins. This is actually, I mean, it sounds bad, but it's actually much more practical than it sounds. I think this is what most people would use. But NCI doesn't like that. They have they would have a sort of an entity-based conflict management, which is much more useful for them. And there are other kinds of conflict management that you can imagine. I mean, currently implemented, the only one that's implemented is strict conflict management, which means that you can only do an update if you're the last guy. Next slide. So I got the wrong end of that. So client has several modes. It has online, where the client sees the updates as they happen, modifies the ontology in real time. But if he goes offline, things still work. And actually, the manual mode is really the same as offline, but it's sort of, it has a different emphasis. The reason I mentioned offline separately is that it's, you know, if the server goes down, you can continue working. And there are hybrid modes also. Next slide. I don't think I want to say much about this here except that it exists. So I'll go to the next slide, too. So time is up.
Yes, okay. So Web Protégé is a web-based client for browsing and editing ontology. Our main motivation in developing Web Protégé was to support collaboration processes for people when they develop ontologies in a community. In our experience, most of the projects involve a community rather than a single person editing an ontology. So in this way, Web Protégé has support for collaboration. First of it is simultaneous browsing and editing of an ontology, support for discussing the classes, properties, individuals, right in the development process, so in the field itself. It has support for watching entities, so for example, in a similar way to wikis, if people are interested in a particular entity, class, or a brand, ontology, they can say, I'm watching this, and they can get notifications if something has changed. It has support for review, a review process for exit policies, where you can say, this group of people cannot edit the ontology, they can only browse, and these people can only comment, and these people cannot edit properties, but only classes, and so on. Our second motivation in developing Web Protégé was to provide a knowledge acquisition tool for domain experts. So we have heard too many times the complaints that ontology editors are too complicated and that domain experts cannot really use them. And we know that domain experts usually are not so knowledgeable about the description. So what we try to do is we try to kind of provide a platform where also domain experts can edit an ontology without necessarily seeing everything in an ontology. So we had to build a highly customizable user interface that can accommodate different user requests, different user expertise. We also tried to build Web Protégé using a pluggable interface. And currently it has Web Protégé has two backends. One of them is the Protégé 3 backend that is used in a production setting already, so it is very stable. And it is used in production for the development of the International Classification of Diseases, ICD-11. But that had only support for hour one. We also have an our API 3 implementation that is still in the alpha stage. We don't have all the features still supported for this backend, but we are working on it, and we hope that it will become the main supported version of WebProtegen. It also supports other backends that previously comes with, like the frames, RDS, and any other previously backends. Next slide, please. So here is just to give you an idea how the default web protocol user interface looks like. We try to use a portal metaphor where, just like iGoogle or My Yahoo, where people can basically put in a tab components that they are interested in. So here you see the Slack history. So the default layout looks very much like the rich client. We try to limit that so that people are familiar with it from the beginning. But this default layout can easily be changed. So users can add what we call portraits, so the class tree, the properties component, the restriction, nodes, what you see here, they are called portraits. And they kind of correspond to what Protegen 4 means by use. So people can basically configure this user interface by dragging and dropping these components around, by resizing, by hiding, by creating new tabs, or even creating a new script. Another thing that, right, so we can go to the next slide. Okay, so I mentioned that it is built as a portal, and it has a declarative user interface in an XML file, which means that changing the default layout or changing a configuration for a particular user and particular project is very easy just by editing XML files. This can be done by administrators on the server side, but also the user himself or herself can configure the user interface by dragging and dropping in the web browser. But if there should be some kind of pre-canned layout that people should see when they log in, this can be done through this declarative user interface. This also means that we can support different views of the same ontology for different users. And this is very useful for some people are usually have different concerns. Some are more interested, you know, in seeing the restrictions, seeing the class. The other people really just want to see the notes and the comments and the annotations of in the ontology. So our goal was to easily adjust the user interface based on the user expertise and tasks. And this came in handy. Next slide, please. Because we try to, the WebProtegen platform tries to allow users to build their own web application using these little pieces, the portlets, the tabs. And this is just one example of this configuration. This is the platform that supports the ICD-11 development. What you see here on the left-hand side is still the class tree, but on the right-hand side, what you see is a portlet, it's a form-based editing portlet. And this is really, this platform is really used by domain experts. And they are used to forms and filling forms. And this is what we try to give them. What they edit actually is your underlying ontology, but they are not really aware of that, and they don't really need to be aware of this at this point. Next slide, please. So here there are just other widgets that are available. So we have several widgets and portlets that are available for users to kind of build their own web application. So we have, you know, things like radio buttons and checklists and drop-down lists. We have a lot of support for 3-5 instances because in our project with the World Health Organization on ICD, everything is really tight, so basically we have a lot of knowledge acquisition with it for real five instances. Next slide, please. Here is just I wanted to give you a very brief idea about the different pieces of WebProtegen. So the user interface of WebProtegen is implemented within the Google Web Toolkit, which is a very nice infrastructure provided by Google in which you write code in Java and then they compile it into optimized JavaScript. and the portlet and the tab, everything that is in the user interface basically is pluggable. So if someone would like to implement their own view, their own portlet, it's very easy. It's exactly like for the rich client where you just implement an interface. So it's one method basically, and you have your own portlet in the web user interface. So that is one part that is pluggable. The other part that is pluggable is the server side. So the user interface and the server are very neatly separated by a layer of services. So basically you can have the same user interface implemented with different backends, basically. And this is also what we did. So for the ontology service on the lower side of the screen, you see that we have an implementation using the Prodigy 3, but also one using the Our API. Also have for the nodes, so for the collaboration, we also have an implementation using the 3 and using the Our API. We are working now on implementing all of the using the Our API. Right now, just these two are available. But also, this part is pluggable, and it's very easy to imagine having backends for Jenna or Triple Sort or any other backend, and still keeping, you know, reusing the user interface for web processing. Next slide, please. So where we are now and what we plan to do. So Web Protege with the Project 3 backend is stable and used in production, but we want to move in the direction of supporting Our API fully. We are finalizing the implementation of the Web Protege with the Our API. There are some missing pieces. What we can use the access policies with the Our API. Here's with the access policies, it's pretty nice with Our API and Protege 3 backend works very well together. We also need to integrate the web protege for client server so that someone can edit the web protege and someone else can edit the same ontology in Protege 4 and they will require changes. That already works for the Protege 3 but not for the Protege 4. And we also add features based on user request. Right, next slide. So we'd like to acknowledge Gilda Moreira, who provided a concurrent implementation of the Our API using Closure. We needed this library for the backend in Web Protege, and it's working very well so far. Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, thanks to Tim and Tanya, and I apologize for not having introduced Tanya properly at the beginning. I hadn't quite realized that you'd be giving the talk in tandem, so thanks for that.
No problem.
So next up is Andreas.
Yes, hello everybody. As you mentioned already, Neon is sort of the new kid on the block in the ontology modeling world. Myself, I'm quite the new kid on the block for the Neon project about a year ago, and was responsible for helping the transition into the Our API and also worked on reasoning and querying plugins. So the core Neon consortium is here, the ISP, and then the university, UPN, CNR from Italy, and on the, there are a couple of other partners. So next slide. I'd like to talk a little bit about the general ideas behind the Neon project, present the Neon toolkit, the Neon toolkit core, and the plugins that extend the core functionality, specifically point out which our two features are currently supported and which we plan to support, introduce to you the Neon Foundation, which pushes the development of the Neon toolkit after the European project ran out, or concluded, and give some summary towards the end. Next slide. So the Neon project is concerned with lifecycle connected ontologies. So the key insight here is that typically in projects you don't have static ontologies, or we have just one single ontology, but we have ontology network, which is illustrated here in the picture. So you have an ontology that's related with another one that has prior versions that depend on other ontologies, or you also have mappings that relate concepts from one ontology to the other. So that's sort of the conceptual model behind the NEON project. So the project itself focuses on methods and tools for ontology engineering. So part of the NEON project was coming up with guidelines and methodologies and design patterns how to best model and construct ontologies, and also tool support, which is implemented in the NEON toolkit and project. Next slide. The NEON toolkit itself is built on Eclipse and the OWL API, so we use version 3, the current one. As such, it's platform independent, and we have built for Windows, macOS, and Linux. It's supposed to cover the complete ontology development lifecycle if extensible via plugins within the Eclipse plugin mechanism. The code is published in a business-friendly license and the Eclipse public license. So if you have commercial applications and want to use the NEON toolkit in one, the license allows you to do so. And next slide. So I mentioned the ontology engineering lifecycle already. So part of the tool support for the management of ontology engineering lifecycle is, for example, the GONF plugin, which is based on the underlying methodology developed by UPN and helps you to schedule ontology projects. So if you plan to develop an application or an ontology, you can use this GONF plugin to do the project management. At the end of the day, you have GONF charts, which allow you connectivities and then dependencies. Next slide. Another part of the methodological thesis in NEON is the ontology design pattern. And you know that how we from software engineers think that there are code patterns or design patterns over Java, C, or other programming languages, and the ontology design pattern work for ontologies. There is a portal maintained by CNR that lists and explains various types of design patterns and gives examples, ontology examples, which implement this design pattern. Tool support in the NEON toolkit for that is the XD plugin, Extreme Design, and it provides the user access to the design pattern registry, so users can select which design patterns they want to use and implement in the ontology. And also when the users finish modeling, they can check whether their ontology actually appears to the design patterns they have been specified. Next slide. The key part of the whole NEON methodology is the notion of modularization, also known from software engineering, where ontologies or the pieces of the code are modeled by different people, and the NEON toolkit supports the separation of concern basically with module plugins, which implement methods for extracting ontology modules from bigger ontologies, partitioning. You just like a Dalton ontology, and then when you have different ontology pieces or ontologies, you can use the composition plugin to bring these together and relate them together. Okay, next slide. So a key part in ontology modeling is reasoning. So we support the reasoners currently, Harmony and Pellet, and it's implemented using the OWL API reasoner plugin mechanism, which is a very nice abstraction for changing the infrastructure. So we give the user functionality for materialization of inferences and also for asking queries against, like asking a Spark query against ontology with or without reasoning. One of the flagship plugins in the recent area is RADON, which stands for Repair and Diagnostic on the Apology Network, and it implements scalable methods for detecting inconsistencies in ontology networks, and also gives the users hints on how to resolve inconsistencies. So what actions to remove to get the ontology network back into consistency. Next slide. Finally, we have visualization plugins. So there are many more. I think there's three or four of visualization plugins. I present in particular here the KCVIS plugin, which stands for key concept visualization. So the idea here is to use ontology summarization techniques to give users a high-level overview of the main concepts and axioms in an ontology. It's based on a variety of methods to derive these concepts. And then just to use a sort of a graph-based view on the shift of an ontology. So if you have very big ontologies, you can get sort of a distilled version of the main aspects of an ontology and get that visualized. Next slide, please. So I mentioned before already that in the Neon Toolkit version 2.3, we use now the Owl API that is different to the previous versions, which were based on the Kaon 2 API. The Owl API supports all our Owl2 features, and some of these Owl2 features are surfaced in the user interface of the Neon Toolkit. So you can read the main features they have supported here on the slide. In the version 2.3, we made a lot of usability enhancements compared to the previous version, but also on the stability of the code, so fixing issues with Max, for example, and added a couple of new functionalities to edit read and the stuff is perfect to the Owl API functionality to the user in sort of the space and UI. If you have used the Neon Toolkit before, like version 1.2, you should probably check out the new version 2.3, 2.3.2 is the current version. Because, as I said, we made a lot of stability and visibility improvements there. So, next slide. So, this is the laundry list of the Owl2 features that are currently supported. Unloading, representing, and serializing is based on the Owl3 API. The features that are listed. Then next are the features that are currently not implemented, so not implemented are anary data ranges, inverse object property expressions, anonymous individuals, and so on. You can read that. But all the other 88 Owl2 features are currently supported in the Neon Toolkit user interface. We plan to add more Owl2 features in the next few months. So next slide is okay. Because we plan to do this development under the umbrella of the Neon Technologies Foundation Limited, which just has been incorporated, and the objectives of the foundation are to promote the uptake of thematic technologies and basically to continue the development of the Neon Toolkit and its plugins, and also to provide training and education to students and particularly to companies or commercial applications using the Neon Toolkit. The foundation comprises of the Neon Consortium, basically the members of the European project that has been carried out until February 2010. We offer partnerships to organizations which would like to help in the development of the Neon Toolkit, and we also provide training services to interpret the titles from sleep to the increases in process. So if you're active in this space and would like to use and contribute to the Neon Toolkit, please let me or her mental promoter from that means that you know and do the strategy. Next slide. Now this brings me already to the conclusion. So as I said, we have a new version of the Neon Toolkit 2.3.2, which is much more usable and stable compared to the previous versions. We have more than 30 plugins available, some of them I presented already. There are others available, you can check that out at the neontoolkit.org website. We plan to publish an enhanced version, again with fixing usability issues and also increasing the coverage of the L2 features for the end of the year. And the ontology design pattern are currently being adapted as a new output feature. So you should see some changes on the application design and also design patterns portal in the coming time. To give you a little bit of summary on applying Neon in commercial projects, so we have a very business-friendly licensing model. The Neon Foundation is up and running and supports commercial and educational applications of the Neon Toolkit. It also governs the future development of the Neon Toolkit, and as it's open source, you can download the Neon Toolkit at neontoolkit.org and also install all the plugins that are available via the Neon Toolkit application. All right, so thanks for your attention. That was my talk.
Thanks, Andreas, for that. That's great. As I mentioned before, we'll keep questions to the end, so we'll move on immediately to Evren. You ready, Evren?
Yes, I'm ready.
Okay, take it away.
Okay, let's go to the second slide directly. Before talking about colors and explaining the future of PERT, I'd like to introduce our company, Clark Empire TV, very briefly. We are a semantic software startup headquartered in D.C. and office in Boston, where I'm located. And we provide software products, application development, and integration services. Colors is one of the products that we develop, but there are also other things that we are doing, design reasoning, in the area of AI planning or just pure RDF-based data integration project. Next slide, please. Slide 3. So Pellet is an old-school reasoner. It's a pure Java implementation, historically started, the development started in the University of Maryland around 2003, when I was also my PhD work there. But for the last 4 years, we had been developing and maintaining the Pellet in the cloud in Parsia. And currently we have a still licensed open source software, which provides a GPL license when you are developing an open source application, and for commercial use, you can buy a commercial application. So we believe this is a good balance for giving academic or other kind of research-oriented projects to use Pellet freely while providing resources for us to continue development and maintenance. And you can go to the website to download the tool and get more information. And I'll be going through several features and expansions of Pellet during the talk too. Next slide, please. Slide 4. So Pellet currently supports all the constructs in OWL2. So all the new additions in OWL2, like property chains, user-defined data types, and keys can be will be processed by the reasoner, and all the inferences that would be computed in results will be produced by Pellet. Talat also supports reasoning with several rules, semantic web rule language, so you can define your rules over all ontologies. So most of the additions in Ubuntu, like property chains, make the use of rules, kind of cover the expressivity provided by rules, but in certain cases, there's some additional expressivity you would gain by using rules, and this would be supported by Talat, using the diaph-based interpretation. This means the rules will only be applied for instances, not gonna be used for reasoning with class hierarchy or the schema in general. And through this, in the rules, we also support built-in functions, which are some kind of mathematical operations or string concatenation kind of functions can be used in rules, which turns out to be very useful when developing some practical applications. So Talat is the sound and complete reasoner. The core reasoner is based on Tableau algorithms developed for description logics, but actually Talat is not a single reasoning algorithm. It's a kind of combination of several different algorithms. And for example, there are more flexible algorithms that can be defined for profiles of ovals, like OVAL2EL and OVAL2GL. And we have those implementations inside Talat. From a user point of view, this is really very important. When you load your ontology, Talat will figure out the kind of most efficient algorithm available and use that to reason with your ontology. So if you have an OVAL2EL ontology, then a more efficient algorithm would be used. Next slide, please. Slide 5. So the reasoning serves provides, I thought, all the standard reasoning features that are available, such as consistency checking. So this is the consistency definition is as it is defined in the OVAL2 specification. So kind of intuitively, the contradictions in the instance data can be found, and classification can be performed, which would compute all the subclass relations or equivalent class relations between named classes. And the realization service would be finding the instances for each named class. And Talat also provides conjunctive querying with Sparkle queries. So Sparkle itself is kind of the W3 spec is designed for querying mostly RDF graphs, but it is also supports entailment regimes, and in fact in all Sparkle 1.1 specification there's a very well written document for how you can use Sparkle to query OVAL2 ontologies, and Talat supports this query answering. And the higher order queries that's mentioned in the slide is basically using Sparkle. You can use variables to create that would bind to clusters. So rather than just instance queries, you can use Sparkle queries for mixed schema and instance queries, which is not a very common service found in DL reasoners. Okay, next slide, please. Slide 6. There are also some additional services provided by Talat. One of them is computation of explanations for any kind of entailment that would be produced by the reasoner. Matthew already mentioned the explanation feature in OVAL API. These are very tightly integrated, actually. So OVAL API provides a reasoner-independent explanation generation. What we have in Talat is a reasoner that is an extension of that service, so there's more support in the reasoner to compute these explanations, which can make a difference in performance and also some advantages for explaining ontology inconsistency. And there's also the module extraction service. Again, there's this service is also available as a reasoner independent service model API. We have kind of some more optimizations and integration with the reasoner in palette. And the modularity that I'm talking here, the theoretical work was actually done by Ian's group at Oxford. So this extraction is based on the notion of syntactic modularity that lets you to compute a subset of ontology that's minimal and that also ensures the completeness of reasoning results for a certain set of entities that you would provide. And this module extraction service is being used in another service that Palette provides, which we call incremental reasoning or incremental classification. So this can be actually sort of an optimization of the standard classification service. So one problem with reasoning is, even though we have lots of optimizations to compute classification results for a given ontology, most of the time there will be some changes to the ontology, and just recomputing everything from scratch can be very costly. So the incremental reasoning feature is to use the modularity service to just recompute the results on the affected modules. So rather than classifying the whole ontology from scratch, we can just classify a smaller subset. And in the end, I will talk a little bit about how this can be very useful in practice. Next slide, please. Slide 7. So how can you use Palette? Well, when you download Palette itself, it comes with a command line interface. So this is a little bit more geared towards developers. So in the command line, there's a pretty extensive support for all the reasoning services I have mentioned and even some more. You can use these through the command line, which is looks like the, some of the well-known command line applications like SVN or others. You can use Palette through a program. Obviously, it's a Java library, as I mentioned. We implement the reasoner interfaces provided in OWL API, as Matthew was telling us about. Palette also supports the Jena library, which is mostly an RDS-based library rather than an OWL library. But, of course, it can be used to load, parse, or serialize OWL ontologies. And we also have support for this kind of RDS-based application to make use of the OWL to reasoning features. We also have a Palette server system that will be released very soon, which provides accessing the features of Palette through a client-server-based architecture. So we will also be releasing a Palette server client written in a in Scala programming language, for example. So you wouldn't be limited to Java programs to use the functionality of Palette by using Palette server. And this is integrated with different browsers and editors. Protégé, we have seen. There's also Palette integration with Protégé 3 versions to OWL site, which is not an editor, just a web-based browser that we have developed also provides several of the reasoning features of Palette, like classification and explanation, that I mentioned in previous slides. Next slide, please. In addition to these reasoning services, which are all around the standard Ubuntu specification. We have some extensions built on top of Pellet. Some of them are more at prototypical stage, so the others are more robust and production ready. So I'm going to go very quickly through some of these. If you're interested in any of these, we have more information on the website and some publications about these. So the first extension I'd like to talk about is the integrity constraint validation. So this extension is to address the use case when you have some instance data that you'd like to validate with respect to your OWL ontology, but due to the open world assumption of OWL, you will not detect some inconsistencies because the reasoner will always assume that there could be more information somewhere. So in those cases, it is more useful to kind of adopt the closed world assumption, say, like, all the instances of this class should have a certain property, and then detect which instances is missing that property value. So we have kind of an extended semantics for these integrity constraints, and an IC validation algorithm by translating all axioms to Sparkle queries. So this reduction can also be used to do validation through some rule-based system too. Okay, the next extension is the Pellet distributed query system, which is to address the use case where there's a distributed set of data sources where there is a large amount of data that cannot be combined in a single repository due to changes that are happening at different sources. So this system kind of allows you to kind of query all these distributed sources as if all the data is stored in a single repository. And of course, the expressivity support by this is not as high as the Pellet itself, because there are various different challenges to reasoning over these data sources, but we can provide completeness when expressivity is limited to some of the OWL2 profiles. Another extension that we built and released is Pellet Spatial, which combines the OWL reasoning capabilities of Pellet with qualitative spatial reasoning. And the spatial reasoning formalism we have chosen is the region connection calculus, RCC, that has been widely used in literature. So this kind of lets you to check consistency of spatial relations. So in RCC, you can describe, for example, there are two different regions, they are next to each other, or one region is completely contained in another region. And you can tell it spatial to kind of see if there are any inconsistencies in your spatial relations, like you said, A is inside B and B is inside A. And you can also have Sparkle queries that use both the spatial relations, but also any other vocabulary you could be using in your ontology, like find me all regions that is contained in the specific region and that has these properties, I don't know, some kind of population or other administrative properties of regions can be considered here, for example. And we also have a probabilistic reasoning expansion where you can associate probability intervals with OWL axioms. And so rather than saying A is subclass of B, or like a common example is, rather than saying bird is subclass of flying animal, you can say the biggest probability a bird would be a flying animal. And if you have some exceptions like penguins, that would be taken into account when you are doing probabilistic reasoning. And the new elements you compute will have probabilities associated with it. There's lots of theoretical work behind this, similar to the other one, so I won't go into details about any of these here. If you are interested, I'd be happy to provide references about that later. Next slide, please. Okay, another expansion built on top of Pellet is PelletDB, which provides reasoning over secondary storage. So Pellet itself is a memory-based reasoner, which means all the information would be loaded into memory and all the reasoning would be done inside memory, which obviously has limitations for scalability. So with PelletDB, one immediate benefit you get is you can persist the reasoning results in secondary storage, so you don't have to recompute them later on. You can also separate schema and instance reasoning, so rather than loading instance data into memory, since instance data is typically much larger than schema data, we can scale reasoning to larger instance data. And version 1.1 is released with tight integration with Oracle RDF Store. So Oracle provides an Oval2 RL reasoner that can be used to do reasoning with instances, and this integration uses Pellet schema reasoning combined with Oracle's instance reasoning. The upcoming 2.0 version will be a little more, will have more features, and it's going to be compatible with more triple stores and have reasoning support for Oval2 QL profiles. And also in the upcoming versions, we'll have support for reasoning over legacy relation databases. So if you have data sitting in standard relational databases, you can define an ontology to map this data, and the querying can be done on the fly without importing the data into some kind of RDF or Oval format. Next slide, please. Slide 10. So we don't have too much time. I'll very quickly mention a couple of applications where we are directly involved with Pellet use. So there are obviously many more applications for Pellet as it is available as open source. So one application where Pellet is used is the ontology development at National Cancer Institute. It has already been mentioned, NCI has this rather large ontology containing 60,000 concepts. There are 5 to 10 knowledge engineers working on this ontology to edit and extend the ontology with cancer-related research terms and their relations. So PELT is being used to do classification and also explanation at edit time. So the incremental classification, which I told you, is very relevant here because for an ontology of this size, for example, the initial classification can take up to 4 or 5 minutes, whereas incremental classification can be done in seconds or milliseconds, which can give close to real-time results when you are developing your ontology. And this incremental reasoning feature is also available in Protege 4 through the Pellet plugin, so you can also try it there. Another application where Pellet reasoning is being used is configuration management. So, for example, configuring software to run on some cloud setup would require installation of several different components. There are complex dependencies between different components, and choosing one component rather than another might have some ramifications that you cannot see immediately. So using an ontology-based, reasoning-based solution here gives you an easy way to handle the configuration management problem, so the reasoner can figure out, based on the definitions in the ontology, what kind of components can go together and in which order they need to be installed. And there's some kind of planning system involved here too. But given the time constraints, let me mention other projects a little bit. One other application where we work with a financial organization is to kind of help with business intelligence problems. Like, we have certain products to sell and some customer information. How can we match these customers? How can we find customers that would be potentially interested in a certain product? And again, reasoning is used. Here, there's also some integration with machine learning components and provide a hybrid reasoning system to do the matching process. And another place where reasoning is used is service-oriented architectures. The iPlant Collaborative, which is a large NSF-funded project for plant sciences, provides a large number of web-accessible services to access certain data and functionality. So all two ontologies are being used to describe the capabilities of the services, and the Palette Reasoner is being used to do the discovery and matchmaking, in the sense that you can send a request saying, I need a service that has these features, and the reasoning can be performed to find which of the existing services satisfy these requirements. And I believe this is it. Next slide, please. Yes. So that's all I have. I have to go very quickly through my slides, but I'd be able to answer questions at the end.
Okay. Thanks a lot for that, my friend.
Thanks.
So as time is getting on a bit, we'll move on quickly to the next and last talk. Again, at the beginning, I think I made a mistake and only introduced Dave Wu, and that, as far as I can see, the talk will actually also be given by Eric Chan. So, and actually, I know that, it may be the case that Eric isn't really called Eric. So I apologize in advance if that's the case. Anyway, guys, off you go.
Yes, this is Eric Chan. Thank you for including us in this panel. I'm chair of the Oasis ICOM PC. I will start off the presentation of ICOM, and then Yi Wu will join me to present the Oracle Semantic Technologies for ICOM applications. Ramesh Pazitivan, Deirdre Lee, Laura Dragon, members of ICOM PC, also contributed to this presentation. They are also in the conference call and will be available to answer questions later on. So let's go to slide number 2. It shows how a user today has to select the application and protocol. For example, to select email client, IM, blog client, to send a message to another person. This interaction is technology driven. It is not declarative and it's not seamless enough. So on next slide, slide number 3, we show that an architecture where we need a standard ontology to expose the data from behind the wall of applications. We would like to let the user write a message and let the system deliver the message through appropriate channels. The system can select the delivery channel according to the user's preferences, presence, and context. On the receiving side, the system can filter important messages from multiple channels into the user's universal inbox. So, next slide, please. Slide number 4. we summarize the problems of the current generation of collaboration tools. We know that they are technology-driven, that require context switching to perform a single task. They are disjoint and incompatible. Therefore, prevent aggregation and reasoning of diverse types of collaboration artifacts. They lack interoperability to collaborate across organizational boundaries and are hard to integrate with business process. Slide number five, please. We need a standard ontology to solve these problems. ICOM-CC was chartered to define a standard ontology to integrate and for interoperable enterprise collaboration. The specification will include classes and properties of collaboration objects for a broad range of collaboration activities will encompass existing technologies and standards developed independently. Slide number six. This diagram on slide number six shows basic entities in ICOM. The ICOM CC will focus on defining generic concepts that can be used to compose specialized concepts and will provide extensibility to meet different requirements. We will try to keep the core concepts more in principle. Please refer to the OS ICOM page, the URL is in one of the subsequent slides, for the concepts that we have defined in core and extension modules. We are now working on the graph specification. Next slide, slide number seven. For ICOM to be language neutral, define it concomitantly in RDS and UML. It can be bound to OO languages such as Java, C#, Objective-C, JSON, etc., and to RDS-R2. It facilitates integration of collaboration services from multiple vendors. One vendor can provide email and calendar service, while another vendor provides document management, and a third vendor provides real-time conferencing services. Next slide, please. Slide number eight. So we have the abstract ICOM model. To validate the utility of the model, we adopted concurrent engineering. We are investigating mapping from different data sources and formats to ICOM. We have represented ontolog forum discussion threads in ICOM RDF for demonstration today. This is a work in progress. There's a URL on this slide. Please refer to the wiki page for progress. Next slide, slide number nine. This graph summarizes how we represent ontolog forum discussion threads in ICOM RDF. Slide number 10. It shows the current organizational members in ICOM CC. There are representatives from different organizations as well as some individuals. We invite you to join the CC and contribute to the effort. Zewul will now take over to present the overview of semantic technologies in Oracle Database. I'll come back later to talk about the user profile extensions in ICOM used for this example application in a demo. Now please go to slide number 11. Zewul will then present.
Hi, thank you, Eric. This is Zewul. I'm going to talk about Oracle Database Database Semantic Technology. Due to time constraints, I'm going to skip slide 12 and to describe the business needs that drive the adoption of semantic technology. Slide 13 and 14 are describing some canonical use cases, applications of semantic technology. You can read them offline and contact us if you're interested. So, slide number 15, semantic application workflow. This slide describes a typical workflow involved semantic technology. It also clearly shows the boundary of our host, which is a platform that supports and manages RDS data in our data. So we have node query and inference capabilities using Oracle data. We are integrated with a lot of tools and partners. For example, OpenClay from Thomson Reuters and the Gate can fit data, can fit RDS data into our platform. Ontology engineering tools like Corporate Composer from CloudQuadrant can be used to manage RDS data and our data stored in Oracle database. On top of this platform, there are tools like business intelligence, graph visualization tools, Cytoscape in particular. We developed a plugin to Cytoscape that can be used to visualize RDS data stored in Oracle database. So next slide, 16. This slide shows some partners that work closely with us in this domain. Slide number 17 shows some Oracle database customers, Cisco, Lilly, Pfizer, to name a few. So if you are interested to know about more details, feel free to contact us. Let's go to slide number 18, capabilities overview of release 11.2. As you can see in this diagram, RDS data, our data, source data, all those graph data are stored in Oracle data, along with relational data. So this is a huge benefit. Basically, you can easily integrate your semantic data with traditional relational data. So we have store APIs like Bulk Loader, Incremental Loader. We have query capabilities, SQL-based, SAM match, query interface, ontology-assisted query of enterprise data. So this allows one to enhance the search capability while consulting an ontology on the side. And inference. We have built-in inference for retraining-based inference engine in Oracle database to support RDFS, both R2RL and user-defined rules in case some specificity are not supported in the rule basis we provide, users can define their own rules. We expose a lot of APIs, SQL and PRSQL APIs and Java APIs through the integration with Jenna and Test. So on top of this layer, there are a lot of NLP engines, ontology editors, increased DL readiness that can plug into this platform. LADB is one example mentioned by Avery in a previous presentation. So slide number 19 and number 20, they show more details about the capabilities. For example, the scalability of database semantic technology, the security aspect. For example, we provide triple level security in the database. It's not done at the application level, so there's no way to bypass that at your application. Slide number 21. So this is the most interesting part of the presentation, I assume. We are going to show a demo application of ICOM with Oracle Business Collaboration and Oracle Database 11.2 Semantic Technology. So this is a joint effort done by ICOM PC, Oracle Beehive team, and Oracle Semantic Technology team. At this moment, I'm going to hand over the control back to Eric, who will describe the application scenario. Thank you.
Thank you. We are on slide number 22. We will demonstrate ICOM application using Oracle Beehive collaboration technologies and Oracle database semantic technology. We have designed a scenario using the data from AutoLog forum. We represented the discussion threads from AutoLog forum in ICOM RDF in Oracle database. This is a work in progress. We are continuing to make more development, investigating how to represent Wiki, Underlog Wiki, and Conquest Data in Account Transfer. But they are not part of the demos yet. We extended the icon tuples with additional tuples for user interest and expertise profiles. Yeah, they will present it in the subsequent slides. Tuples for user interest are generating Beehive expertise extraction tool, which profiles the user interest and expertise based on the user's authorship of artifacts. In this case, we are passing through the discussion messages in Underlog. The user interest profiles are then used to connect information seekers to the right people at the right time for collaboration. Let's go to slide number 23. The Beehive Facet tool passed the now phrases from the discussion text. It ranked the phrases by composition of words and relative frequency of use. It ages the terms through a moving window of time. Terms extracted from the phrases are associated with the users as part of the user interest profile. The users can declare the terms in their profiles as public, but depending on the source, initially, the terms may be protected, but if it's coming from Underlog discussion which is public, the terms may be declared already as public. Protected terms are leveraged by a single blind broker. By this, we mean the information seeker may see the topics aggregated from the terms, but they cannot identify the owner of the terms. The broker can connect the seeker with the owner and leave it up to the owner to reveal his or her identity. Next slide. On slide number 24, it shows the user interface for a search application. Besides finding the contents, this application can also find the users who have interest in expert profiles matching the search terms. We rank the search terms by the strength of the term, the social proximity of the user and the profile owners, and responsiveness of the expert and availability of the expert. And from here, we will present the how-to references, parcels, and SQL queries behind this application.
So now we are at slide number 25. ICOM are here posting a particular ICOM Underlog forum message. So the sounds are a bit small, as you can see in the user interface. It's a snippet of the idea. Some of the predicates are each particular message at a delivered time in 2009. It has a particular sender, it has parent, and also this message is replying to another message. So basically, this snippet of RDF shows some interesting metadata relevant to this particular email message. And we have this URL listed in the first bullet. So you actually can paste this URL into your browser and see the details. You can show the content in one slide. So this is the ABOX part of the RDF data describing the Underlog forum. We also use schema, the T-box, for example, the RDFS subclass, pin domain, and range for mutual suspect. We also use our two topic chain. In this particular case, we define a chain consisting of three predicates as element, as topic, as message, which together is a subtopic of campaign. So this actually, this definition can simplify the query. I'm going to show that in a moment. So slide number 26. This is another usage of our two topic chain in our model. And we notice that this kind of a recursive definition of relations is quite common in social network applications. slide number 27. This actually shows if you dereference this particular URL, this message URL, you will see the body of this particular Onslaught forum message. Going to slide 28. We are showing a sample query, a very generic query. This actually is simplified by using our property chain. I highlight the first query in which this S contains an object. This contains actually is a chain, it's a chain element, SM defined using the other set key. So users do not have to understand all those schema definitions for this icon RDS modeling. They can use this generic simplified predicate to find interesting information. Slide 29, the query result. So there are three columns. The first column is the user's email address. Okay, the second column is the message. Basically, this user wrote a message. The third column is the workspace name, which contains all those relevant email messages. Slide 30. Eric mentioned that we extract interest or expertise based on the Onslaught forum email archive. In this particular query, we ask for users who have interest in a particular term of our ontology. So this is a very straightforward sparkle query. Slide 31 shows the result of a list of users who have interest in upper ontology. There are in total 28 users. We highlight one as Patrick Cassidy because we're going to click on that particular result. Going to slide 32 shows that, you know, Patrick has many interests. This is just a section of the overall result. If we click on one particular interest ID, we model interest using a URI, and we have some descriptive text describing a particular interest ID. So if we click on particular interest ID, goes to slide 33, it shows that this particular interest is actually about multiple areas in relation. So this type of term is extracted from all this email archive. We also notice that there's another person shares the same interest on this particular subject. Going to slide 34. In a social network application, it's quite difficult to ask for users to share interest with a particular person. So we construct such a query, such a powerful query, to find out all those users who share interest with this particular young as a whole. Okay. We are using powerful 1-1 features here. So actually, we are using Kisaki and Gen adapter, and they are querying the underlying Oracle database. Slide number 35 shows the query result. There are two columns. Method 1 shows the user to share interest with jump as source. So the second column shows the number of shared interest. We highlight one particular tag here, which has more than 600 shared terms with jump as source. Now, to see the exact interest shared by this person, we can reconstruct another query. So basically, when you find out the first query pattern finds out the interest from John F. Sower, second query pattern finds out interest from Patagaya, and then join them together. We also add a predicate, a filter, to filter out long logic related terms. Slide 37 shows that the two persons Pat Hayes and John F. Sower has common interest in completeness of first-order logic, common logic version of FOL, among others. So slide 38, this is end of this presentation. If you want to know more about ICOM, there are links provided on this page. If you want to know more about Oracle Database Management Technologies, you can click on that link. We also have presentations we did on SEMTAC 2010. Those are all for OCM. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks very much to Eric and Z. Well, as I suppose everyone can see, we are more or less completely out of time now. So I don't know how we're going to play this. Peter?
So maybe you just wrap up the session and we can have people make their post to the Ontolog forum if they have questions for the presenters for those who are...
That seems a reasonable way to go. So I'm sorry that we don't have any time for discussion. I mean, actually, one of the reasons for that is all of the talks were so interesting and informative that I didn't really want to cut any of them short. So even as it was, people had to skip through the material fairly quickly. And so I'm sure people had lots of questions that they'd like to ask. And as Pete was just mentioning, we're going to have to take those offline. And so if you send your questions in via the Ontolog mailing list, I'm sure that the various presenters will be happy to pick them up and try to answer them as best they can. So really at this point nothing remains other than to thank again all of the seven presenters, Matthew Horridge from Manchester, Timothy Redmond and Tanya Tudorak. Sorry, I'm not really good at pronouncing a surname, from Stanford and BMIR, Andreas Hart from Karlsruhe, Efren Spirin from Platinum Partia, and Eric Cannon and Dee Wu from Oasis and Oracle. Thanks a lot for excellent presentations. Thanks to everyone for listening, and I can only apologize again for the fact that we ran out of time. I noticed someone on the chat was suggesting a follow-up session where we could have a discussion. That's something I guess you can take up. You can take up the speaker offline. So thanks again, everyone, and bye.
Yeah, thank you very much, Ian. This is a fantastic session. Thank you for championing this for us. So bye, everyone. And those of you who have been here before knows we will be. We have recorded this session and the audio archive as well as the slides and chat transcript will be available in a day or two. Just come back to the session page and that will be it. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.